Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Within the pages of The Trail of Ted Bundy, digging up the untold stories, you'll hear the voices, many for the first time, of some of Ted Bundy's friends as they bring to light the secrets of what it was like to know him while he was actively involved in murder. The stories of his victims are here as well, as told by their friends, including the information and anecdotes that didn't make it into the investigative files and are being published here for the first time. Two of the former detectives who worked with author Kevin Sullivan during the writing of his widely acclaimed book, The Bundy Murders, return to aid readers in fully understanding Bundy's murderous career, its ripple effect impact on those who came into contact with him in one way or another, and dispelling commonly held myths. The Trail of Ted Bundy is a journey back in time to when Ted Bundy was killing young women and girls in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. It's told by those who knew him, and you'll hear the revealing stories, many being voiced and put to print for the very first time. The friends of the victim are here as well, and they too share their insights about the victims, and some of what they tell here had been held back from the investigators. Such was their commitment to their deceased friends. It's also the story of those who hunted Bundy, those who guarded him, and those who otherwise were a part of this strange case, one way or another. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories, with my special guest, journalist and author, Kevin Sullivan. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Kevin Sullivan.
Well, thank you, Dan, for having me back, and I knew you were going to have me back on after I completed this. Good to see that it's gone to print, and I'm ready to talk about it.
Well, it's always a great pleasure talking to you, and always exciting for the audience to hear anything new about the very fascinating Ted Bundy and also the very fascinating Kevin Sullivan. So let's talk about, you just talk about it in your intro. So just tell us why, after doing what an exhaustive and the most comprehensive, I guess, story about Ted Bundy, the most complete story to date about Ted Bundy with the Bundy murders. And I know you talk about how someone, a co-author, had asked about a possibility of writing about something just a couple of years ago, and you said no. So
sure.
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Why now, and why?
Yeah. The writing of the Bundy murders was a 2.5-year marathon. It literally was a day and night thing. There were no days off, and it was day and night, and it was 2.5 years. And so once I was finished with it, I said, this is in the book, and I was exhausted physically and emotionally from being in that world, as it were. And once I was free of it and it went into publication, I slowly kind of like returned to myself, and I was able to go on to other things. And, of course, the case stays with me, okay? There's not a day goes by I don't think about the victims, about Bundy and everything that happened. And that happens with a lot of books that I write, and it happens with a lot of writers. But I could bang out the occasional article. I could go on a radio program like I'm doing here tonight, and that was okay. But I swore that I would never write any other books about Bundy or go back into what I call that dark world. It's true. A couple of years ago, another author asked me to co-author a book on possible murders he may have been involved with. But at the time, the very thought of doing that just really turned me off. And I said to myself, I just can't do this. So, you know, I mean, I thought it over for a while, but I told the person, no, I was going to pass on it. I just didn't want to do it. And that's the way it remained for the last couple of years. But last spring, I was on the phone with somebody, and I can't say who the person is, but they're closely connected to the Bundy case, and they've been having some significant medical problems. And I got to thinking about that and the voices that are still out there that maybe haven't contributed as much to the Bundy saga, as it were. And I thought to myself, you know, it's been 41 years since all of this happened. If I ever want to record any more voices about this very infamous case, I need to do it now. And I think that was the impetus, was of course, speaking to this person. And so with that, I started down the journey. And it was exactly like with the Bundy murders, because I didn't have to rewrite a biography of Ted Bundy or follow him closely on his trail of murder. But it was going to be seeking out those who knew him, those who knew the victims, consulting the case files again, talking to some of the investigators again, and just for posterity, because as a historian, it's very important to me to gather these voices together and get them in print, because one day all these voices will be silent, and then that's it. You can't gain anything from them. So when I began the book, I thought, you know, here I go again. I got to find out. I got to locate people who have either never talked before, or haven't been printed before, or have basically stayed away, from the case. And I didn't know how fortunate I would be in finding people, but I ended up being pretty fortunate. And there were some people that helped me along the way locate some people, and then there were other people that I didn't think I would find, but after doing investigations, I was able to find them. And the greatest thing about it is that most of the people that I talked to talked with me and opened up with me, and some were opening up for the very first time. So it was, I never expected to write another book about Bundy, but as soon as I decided to do this book and record voices that had never been recorded before and get their stories into print, it had a great feel to it, and I knew I was on the right path. And then when I started discovering all these people and they started talking to me, I thought, yep, this was the right decision. And so that was really the genesis of this book.
Now, you start off in Chapter 1 in January 1974, and you focus on the Washington State murders.
Yes.
And we talk about the M.O., and you talk a little bit about Bundy's, early life and his other the other family members. Mm-hmm. He was out of wedlock,
yes.
Born out of wedlock in Philadelphia. But let's talk about, as you do, in January 1974, the Ted Bundy's M.O. In the Seattle area with the murders. So as you talk about in the first chapter, let's talk about that.
Okay. Bundy was a meticulous planner of murder, and he was never better at murder than when he was in Washington State. And that was for a couple of reasons. He knew the area well, and he knew where he wanted to have body dumps. And he didn't leave anything to chance. Later in his career, by the time he gets to Florida, he's a mess. He's very sloppy. But in Washington State, and even again in Utah, and as he branched out from there, he planned murder very well. His M.O., was one of, he was a not just a careful planner of murder, but sometimes he would seize an opportunity if he saw it and it was there. Many of his murders occurred because he went hunting for victims. Sometimes they occurred because they just happened. For example, if he saw a girl hitchhiking. Bundy had a standard way of killing his victims, and there were a number of women that he would whack in the head with a crowbar, once, two, three times. He wanted her unconscious, but he didn't want her dead. And when he wanted a woman unconscious, he wanted to be able to do sexually what he wanted to do with her, and then strangle her while he's having sex with her, and he would kill her in that manner. During those murders, and there were a number of them just like that, he wasn't concerned about her interacting with him. Okay. And so that's what he wanted. Oh, there were sometimes, as with the women at Lake Sammamish, Janice Ott and Denise Naslund. Naslund was gotten in the afternoon, but in the morning he had gotten from Lake Sammamish, Janice Ott. He had kept her somewhere, sexually attacked her, kept her tied up, kept her alive all afternoon. And then he went back to the lake before 4 p.m., and he was able, I think by about 4:20, to convince Denise Naslund to go with him. He had some ruse. He just made up some excuse and tricked her. She got in his car and left. And she was taken to where Janice was. The two women saw each other, terrified, just terror beyond description. And, of course, he sexually assaults, Naslund. And then we don't know which one, but he kills one in front of the other. And, of course, even before anybody was dead, the place was filled with horror. These women knew that they weren't going to get out of this, I'm sure. But once he had killed one in front of the other, he enjoyed the fact. He drank it in. It was like fuel to him that the other person saw it. He meant her to see it. And her terror must have been just unimaginable. And he enjoyed that. But there were times he wanted to kill a woman. He didn't want her to feel terror. And there were some times he wanted to kill his victims. He wanted them to know everything going on. So the MO basically stayed about the same. And that would be choking a woman to death while he's having intercourse with her from behind, either anal or vaginal. And so that the muscles, as they're expiring, they're tightening up their muscles, which would include her vagina. And, that's the kind of person that we're dealing with, okay? So he liked that. And then, of course, he loved necrophilia. So if he had time, he would stay with them and have additional sex acts. Sometimes, as with the hitchhiker that he picked up on his way to law school in Idaho, he probably had, sex with her after he knocked her out a time or two, strangled her to death, and then maybe had, additional sex with her. But he slid her body into the river, and that was it. But sometimes if Bundy planted a body, he could either go back and visit the body, or in the case of Washington State, even back in Washington State. He admitted, he told Bill Hagemeyer, he had as many as 4 heads in his apartment at the Rogers rooming house on 12th Avenue in Seattle. I think 12th Northeast. I can't remember the exact address, but at one time. And of course, people need to understand this isn't because he just wanted to view these heads, okay, and put lipstick on them. He was obviously using these heads for oral sex. This is the demented, diabolic individual that we're talking about. But even within his MO, it could vary a little bit. And it wasn't until the MO really changed with the killing of Lynette Culver in Pocatello, Idaho, in May of 75, where he changed it a little bit. So you could say that Bundy's MO stayed almost the same. There would be some differences in it. But for example, when just to throw this out since we're talking about MO, when he if the people listening now followed the Bundy case at all, they know who Carol Durant is. Carol Durant, right, was kidnapped from the Fashion Place Mall, and Bundy took her to about a block and a half away, stopped at a place called the McMillan School, and she had to fight him to get away from him. She's the only person that ever got away. She said she saw he had a crowbar. She could feel it. She was fighting, but she also said he had a pistol that night. Now, the prosecutors, the prosecuting attorneys out there, they told me they really don't think that Bundy had one, but there is that possibility he had a pistol. So if he did have a pistol on that night, if he did, that would be a little, that I think that would be a significant change in his MO, because except picking up a .22 rifle when he was on the run at that cabin in Colorado after his first escape, except having a gun at that time, there is no mention of a firearm anywhere. Bundy doesn't mention it. But like I say, if he did have a pistol in Utah, at least on that night, that would have changed that MO just a little bit. Anyway, that gives you an idea.
What was Ted Bundy doing in his alter life at that same time in Washington? You say he's very prolific and he's as good as he ever gets in terms of serial murder, and he's a very good serial murderer.
Right.
What was his alter life really like at that time?
Well, it's said that Bundy, I like to say that his launch into murder happened in January of 1974. And he probably killed in 73. We don't know. I even think he may have killed Anne Marie Burr back in 61. But we know he launched into murder, a full unabated murder, where he wasn't going to come back from it in January of 1974. Well, prior to that time, in 73, Bundy was, he was working with the Republican Party. He was, he was rubbing shoulders with some of the political elites there. He was dating Liz Kendall. She has a daughter. He was preparing for law school. And so he was conducting himself in a normal professional fashion. And that was the mask. Now, the interesting thing is there may have been a time in Bundy's life, despite these things on the inside of him, what I call in the Bundy murders, these dark emissaries, like circling, just like a cloud over him or something. He might have thought that maybe I can pull this off. Maybe I can be a lawyer. Maybe I can be the governor of Washington. Maybe I can do this despite all these things going on of what I really want to do. And so there might have been a back and forth within Ted Bundy. But by January of 74, he had already internally waved goodbye to that. And when he attacked that one woman that he didn't kill, which some people identify her as Joni Lentz, where he attacked her in the U District about, 2 or 3 weeks, I don't have the exact date, before he attacked Linda Ann Healy. But he didn't kill her. He thought he was going to, but he didn't do it. But he launched himself then. Now, from that moment on, Bundy still went about his business. He would go to law school for that year at the University of Puget Sound. He would, still do some political stuff. But as the murders increased that year, I noticed in the record that his attendance at these political rallies started to fall off. And like there was a caucus being held in Laurelhurst, I think in June. I'd have to go back and check my book, The Bundy Murders. But I think this caucus was in Laurelhurst, Washington, in June of 74, and he missed it. And it said in the record, and I put this in the book, the second delegate, a lady named Helen West, had to take his place. So by then, not only was he missing things, I don't even think he was contacting people and saying, look, I just can't do this anymore. So he was emotionally cutting his ties with everything that was normal in his life. That's why 1974, even if he killed before then, that's why 1974 is so significant, is because he launched himself into this world of murder, and he was not going to stop for any reason until he was captured or killed. So that's basically his MO. He was leading a normal life, apparently. But the life that could not be seen by his friends and his coworkers was that of a diabolical murderer, and the only people who ever saw that were the women who were captured by him.
Now, you talk about from Washington State, January to September 11, women. Why does he move from Washington? What's the impetus for him to move from Washington State, this place that he knows real well and this is popular and successful hunting ground? What makes him move?
Yeah, sure. He, Bundy came to realize over time that he was going to drive himself out of every area where he was killing women. He decided, to leave Washington and go to Utah, to the University of Utah School of Law, in the fall of 74. Now, by the fall of 74, there was a red-hot manhunt in the Pacific Northwest for this killer of women. You got to understand that when serial murder occurs in an area, it's not always recognized as serial murder until certain patterns emerge. And when those patterns emerge in Washington State, and they culminated at Lake Sammamish, up until Lake Sammamish, which is July 14th, 1974, up until that time, they had a number of missing women, women that vanished under very strange circumstances. Nobody wanted to come out and say the girls have been murdered and they're dead. Cops, of course, suspected this. People suspected it, but they didn't want to believe it. But once Lake Sammamish occurred, where a guy named Ted driving a Volkswagen had lured two girls away, and they're gone, it was a whole different ball game. And the manhunt got very, very extensive out there. And so he wanted to go to law school, but what he really wanted was a new killing ground. And I believe the reason why he chose Utah is because his girlfriend, Liz Kendall, and I use her last name. It's actually Clofer or something like that. But that's the name she chose for her book, The Phantom Prince. So, I mean, I also honor that. I call her Liz Kendall. She's from Utah. And so, you know, she would go home to see her folks. He would go with her. He got to know that area fairly well. So for him, moving to Utah wasn't like just moving somewhere that he didn't have any knowledge of. But here's the thing about Utah. When he got to Utah, he was like a kid in a candy store, because he was becoming a very, very good murderer, and he was having a lot of luck, and he was very disciplined, and he was just good at what he was doing. And he only attended school, at the law school, that first semester three classes. The rest of the time was spent hunting and killing. And even though he didn't have normal body dumps like he did in Washington State, he would put these women at various places and he would dump them. And he kicked it up a notch in Utah, because in Utah, he was bringing some of his victims. And this takes cojones, but as does a lot of things he did. But he took the victim's apartment on the second floor at 565 First Avenue and kept them in there for a number of days. Probably they were in a comatose state, but nevertheless, they were still breathing. And then he had to kill them and slip them out. But when he got to Utah, there was no manhunt. But if you'll notice, after a bunch of girls start, you know, disappearing, and then some are found murdered in Utah, like Melissa Smith and Lauren and Amy. Here's what Bundy does. Well, I've made this place hot, just like Washington State. I've got to go somewhere else. So what does he do? Come January of 75, he heads to Colorado, and he starts hunting at the ski resorts. So yet again, he's going to an area that is a neighboring state, but thus far hadn't had any missing or murdered women. And then they start dying over there. So that was his MO. So it's just like when he finally made it to Florida and he turned Tallahassee upside down by killing two at Chi Omega and attacking Cheryl Thomas at her Dunwoody apartment. What's he do? He gets in the stolen van and he goes to Jacksonville to get away from Tallahassee. So Bundy was always getting away from what he had created to go somewhere else to find victims. He never found anybody in Jacksonville. He almost did, but he didn't. Came back, and his last murder was committed in Lake City, 12-year-old Kim Leach. But that's why he did it. So he was a very mobile killer, and of necessity. He loved to drive anyway. He loved to troll. But of necessity, he had to change locations because of how hot these manhunts got in these, respective states.
What's fascinating is his dissension. When he goes, like you say, you talk about Colorado, and you demonstrate that with all these cases and the precision and the charm that he had,
yes,
and that he exhibited. And so by the time he gets to Aspen, though, by the time he gets to Colorado, he is not as suave. He's standing in the cold without any ski apparel. He seems out of place. Mm-hmm. And then by the time he gets to Florida, people describe him as creepy and greasy. So
yeah,
let's just talk about a little bit, by the time he gets to Colorado, how things have changed. Things are always a little bit similar with him, but what has changed by the time he gets to Colorado?
Well, not having warm clothes and hunting at the ski resort was a mistake because he stood out. And as I say in the book, and I also cover this in the first book, there was a woman named Elizabeth Harder who saw this strange man, and you know, he just had pants and a shirt on. And he's standing back out of the light near a service closet. The elevator opens, and she sees him. And of course, he, you know, soon after that, he got Karen Campbell. Now, that was a mistake because he should have, but you know, had something warm on so he could blend in. That said, he hadn't descended at that point. He was still very, able to get women to leave with him. And what happened was, and of course I've been there and I know how it works. And when you're walking those outside walkways, you can see everything around you. But something that Bundy noticed and he took advantage of was that in close to zero weather, the heated pool on the outside, people would swim even in January. And that pool would have so much steam wafting up from the surface of the pool that very often you couldn't see. And of course, it's also like in the evening, you couldn't see who's walking along sometimes on the second floor outside walkway. You couldn't even see sometimes people passing on the little walkways around the pool because there's that much steam. Bundy would not have missed that. But so it's true he wasn't dressed in warm clothing, but he was still a what I would call a meticulous planner of murder even then. Where you see the real meltdown is in Florida. But Colorado, he was still the kind of person. And see, the difference is that in Florida, that charm had left him. In fact, in Florida, women got a creepy feeling around him. I mean, it's like he was giving off these vibes and nobody wanted to be around him. And I say in my book, The Bundy Murders, that when he couldn't, and this was unthinkable back in Washington State, even Utah, he could go up to women then and went, "Oh, he's an attractive young guy. He's articulate. Yeah, let's talk. I'm going to go out and get a beer. Yeah." See, that's the way it was. Not in Florida. He walks up to people at the disco right across from Chi Omega in Florida. And this guy's creeping them out. There was women who told detectives later, "We were hoping he wouldn't come up to us. He had this weird look in his eyes." So that kind of killer, the suave killer, the killer that is really, really on target, was gone from him. And that's why I say in the book, The Bundy Murders, he couldn't get the conscious women to leave with him. So he attacked the unconscious women at Chi Omega, those ladies that were asleep. So that's where you see the real meltdown. And I go into great detail about all the things that were evident of the meltdown as Bundy was on his trail of murder in Florida. But it's interesting that Colorado thing. And, you know, if you've been there, if you have to be there, there's a lot of ski resorts. And how he ended up at this particular resort, at that particular place, it's all a matter of chance. And because the place it's got stuff all over there. So, yeah, it's just interesting. And, you know, I say this in the Bundy Murders. It's this woman that he led away willingly to a parking lot. This has had to have happened. And he must have waylaid her at the parking lot. Her name was Karen Campbell. She was a nurse from Michigan. She was there with her boyfriend, Dr. Raymond Godowski, and his two kids. And then there was another doctor, a friend of theirs, that was there. The kids wanted to – she had to go up to her room to get a magazine so she could switch the magazine with this other doctor that was with them. The kids wanted to go with her. Now, just think of this. Just to think of what is hinging on life and death. Had she said, no, stay with your father. Had the kids gone with her, Bundy would have had no choice but to leave her alone. She'd have gone to her room, gotten a magazine, gone back down the elevator with the kids, gone downstairs, and she and Raymond Gadowski would probably be married today watching TV right now as we talk. The girl was by herself. Karen was by herself. That's why I say in my book, sometimes it's just a matter of chance, just chance, that these things happen. And so whatever Bundy did, he convinced her. We don't know the ruse. We don't know whether he probably wasn't hobbling. He probably used some other excuse. He might not have pulled the policeman thing on her. I don't know. We don't know. But he used some ruse and got her to walk to one of the parking lots and, probably the one that even we used right next door off to the right, because that's the closest area to it. And then that was it. And Mike Fisher, when he was doing his investigation, he came to the conclusion without knowing who did this and what his MO was, that whoever got Karen Campbell had her, he had gotten Karen willingly to go with him, at least to the parking lot. And he was right about that. So anyway, but he was still an on-target killer in Colorado, but he sure stood out to Elizabeth Harder. And the sad thing about this is that Harder didn't even tell Fisher the first time. A year later, when he came back to interview a doctor again, he said, well, you need to go talk to Mrs. Harder, who was also there. And Harder knew this doctor because she said she saw this strange man. And when Fisher got there and talked to her, and then, you know, he showed her some pictures to her, she identified him. So, you know, interesting. And Fisher could have had that information a year earlier, but she held on to it. I don't know why.
You talk about chance. Let's talk about the huge error that happened in Colorado that facilitated him getting down to Florida, escaping twice in Colorado. Let's talk about the escapes and how it possibly could have happened. And it's so movie-esque, the last escape, so give us the details, how it could happen.
Yeah, sure. It does. Well, you know, I can just say this, that people don't surprise me. They just don't. I mean, it's like, if you're a clear-thinking person, you just have a sense of what you should do in situations, especially if there's the possibility of danger. I mean, there's just certain ways you need to conduct yourself in life. But as you know, and the audience knows, we run into people all the time that we think are clueless. Now, when that happens, when you run into clueless people who are watching lethal killers, that can be a problem. So when Ted Bundy was delivered by Michael Fisher and three of his guys to the jail in the Aspen courthouse, at that time, he warned them. He warned them what a risk this man was. Now, the Aspen courthouse, the jail in the courthouse, I mean, they dealt with drunks, bad check writers, people that got into various problems. They didn't usually have somebody like Bundy. But he made it abundantly clear that this man is not just going to stand trial for the abduction and murder of Karen Campbell, but he is suspected of killing women in Utah and Washington State. You can't turn your back on him. Well, turned on the charm. Ted did what he always does. Turned on the charm. Got really friendly with everybody. Everybody kind of liked him, you know. And up in the courthouse, he used to go in and do research in the law library because, having some law school under his belt, he worked, you know, with the attorneys that helped him. And he had use of the library. At the time, they used to keep, in the springtime, the top window open so you could get a breeze, okay? Now, if you stand in front of the courthouse, and I mentioned this in the book, it looks like it would be something to jump out of it when you're standing on the ground floor, because he jumped out. If you ever see a picture of it, it's the top left window second floor window. If you go up into that room, and now it's a court, it's not the library, it is a it's a court, but they still have a lot of the library books on the wall. And you can look out that window, and boy, that it's a daunting drop. It really is. It's something. I mean, you look at it from up there, I'm surprised he didn't break his leg. He did injure the leg. I think he injured his knee a little bit, but by the time he was recaptured 5-6 days later, it was very swollen. But it's a very high drop. Well, anyway, so he gets out this window. He sprints, you know, away. They don't know he's gone yet. Comes in there and says, "Hey, there's a guy just jumped out of your window." And they're thinking, "Oh my God, let's hope it's not Bundy." But Bundy gets, he goes down by the, I think it's the Red Gorge or something. I can't remember the Red River Gorge. It's something, and then he takes off and he gets into the wilds of Colorado, and he's got to make it a. He's trying to make it the Crested Butte, and he's trying to go over the mountain. And he spends a lot of time going in circles. He ends up getting in a cabin, and he ends up doesn't even know what he's doing. But he's losing a lot of weight. He's becoming delirious. He's just what the jailers couldn't do. The wilds of Colorado was doing, and it was corralling him. He finally comes back, and he thinks he's somewhere else. He steals a car. He's a bad driver anyway. He's weaving this car. Police see him. They think he's a drunk. Stop. They find out the person's not drunk. It's just Ted Bundy. He's arrested. Okay. Put in leg irons. Now he gets transferred later. Now you'd think that's a wake up call. You'd think, no, yeah. Not a wake up call. Stupidity still reigns in the minds of some people. He gets transferred to the other jail. I think it's the Garfield County Jail. And they put him in a cell where there's a light fixture. It's a fairly good size. It needed to be welded. But the sheriff and the people in charge determined that there's no way he could get up through there. But just check this out. Again, Michael Fisher warns them. Jerry Thompson warns them. Everybody's warning them. If this guy gets out, he's going to kill again. You can mark it down. Women will die. So what do? They didn't weld it. Now, just check this out. This almost sounds like fiction. The inmates in the jail were telling the authorities, "We hear Ted Bundy moving up above us at night. He's trying to figure out a way to escape. We hear him moving all about above us, and then he goes back to his cell." And they don't do anything about it. He gets out the second time. He slips down into a jailer's apartment, changes clothes. He's got like $700 on him from people who in Washington State and perhaps Utah, most of it came from Washington State, who believed that he was innocent. He had this cash on him. That's $700. I mean, in today's money, that's probably, $2,500. And so he used that money to escape. He stole a car, but that broke down. He hitched a ride with a soldier to Denver, caught a flight to Chicago, took a train to Ann Arbor, and then from Ann Arbor stayed a few days, wanted to go to the university setting. He loved to kill women he was so comfortable with the university setting. So he found a school, an oceanfront school in Florida, and he couldn't. So he decided to take Florida State University, and then he stole a car, came down through Louisville, stopped one morning, had breakfast on Jefferson Street at Uncle Hank's Pancake Cottage, drove on down to Atlanta, dumped the car, picked up a Trailways bus, took that to Tallahassee, and then went on College Avenue and got a room as Chris Hagen, and he passed himself off as a graduate student because he was older then. And so that's how it happened. So these women that were the two women of Kai Omega and Kim Leach, these people should be alive today. The only reason they're dead is because of the jailers in Colorado. There is no other reason. They're only dead because they didn't do their job. So some people lost their jobs, but the women in Florida, these women lost their lives, two women and a young girl. So there you have it. So that was stupidity par excellence, and it's just unbelievable. Two times, he got away from Colorado.
Well, to Ted's credit, he's a diabolical mastermind. If there is any kind of archetype that you could use in a movie, there will be a Ted Bundy movie, and it'll be a blockbuster, no doubt. I mean, the guy looks like Greg Kinnear. He really does. It's eerie. He looks like all-American, like Greg Kinnear, the actor, you know. But anyway, I wanted to talk about this information that's not so well-known, that it, and you've painted a vivid portrayal of it when you talk about his rampage starting January 14th in Florida, when he goes and starts looking for victims, but he's now this creepy guy. So January 14th, he goes hunting. January 15th, he has to outdo himself. From the day he abducted two women at the same time, he is, his crimes have escalated, and he's more desperate, and the authorities are looking for him. So describe, as you do in the book, January 14th, his unsuccessful hunting trip, and then the very horrifying January 15th. And especially want to talk about the Cheryl Thomas, when he gets to the duplex, and her friend Debbie Cicerelli basically saves her life. So let's go back to January 14th in Florida.
Well, if you're talking about the that had to do with the Chi Omega, I don't know if you know this, but Chi Omega occurred on the same night as the attack on Debbie. They both happened on the same night. Yeah, they did.
That's right.
And now on the 14th, you know, he. They believe that the murders didn't occur until that time in Florida, until that date when he attacked all three people. Now, on the 14th, I can't remember what are you drawing from exactly, because I can't remember anything from that period of the 14th. So you'll have to refresh my memory.
Well, what happens is he's been there only a couple weeks, and he. He basically is having some problems with luring people anywhere. So he's striking out with the kinds of things that the ruses that he did before. People are hesitant to do anything with him. So, like you say, he has to resort to people that are sleeping. He finds the sorority house that's just down the street. He creeps in there. He cases out the place earlier, makes sure that the doors are unlocked, then goes in there.
Yes.
And attacks four people, killing two. So.
Okay, you're talking about Chi Omega. Yes, that night at Chi Omega, the Sherrods or Sherrods, I don't know exactly how you pronounce it, but that is that was it's gone now, but that was right next door to Chi Omega, and there were some Chi O girls in there. That night, and there was a lot of people. It was like a disco. So, I mean, they had people coming from all over. Bundy was in there. That's one of the people that, that's one place where a number of these girls later came to the detectives and said, look, there was this weird guy in here. And they described him to a T. And, of course, that was Bundy. Now, when he left, there was one woman reported that I can't remember because this isn't in the new book. This is in the Bundy Murders. It might have been around midnight or 1 a.m., maybe around midnight. One of the girls came out from this charade, and somebody called out to her, "Are you Chi O? Chi Omega?" She said no, and he said, "Well, you're lucky." That was probably Bundy. That was probably him because he probably already determined that he was going to attack the women in Chi Omega. Now, I don't think he had tried the door and found it open. I think, because I know he did that when he attacked Linda Ann Healy, when he followed them home from Dante's in Washington State to her place in the roomy house that she lived in with a girl. He did try the door. It was unlocked. He came back later and attacked them. But the sliding door, which had a keypad lock on the outside, sometimes they would shut it really well, and the next girl coming in would have to use the keypad. And sometimes they would not shut it so well, and you could slide it open. And what happened was one of these girls must have just left it kind of open, and he got in that way. What is interesting about Chi Omega is that it was a frenzy. It was not the MO of what Bundy usually, you know, had. I mean, he just, it was so different. He went in there and he had gotten a log from around the back, and he went in there, and I mean, he was bashing these women in the head, and he would have sex with someone. He would rape them. The one girl, I think it was Lisa Levy, he bit her in the buttocks. And so it was just a frenzy of killing. And, you know, one would think after that is done and he's had his ejaculations, maybe 2-3, who knows, and he's killed them and he's satiated that, but he's not satiated. And this is unbelievable. He keeps the bloodied log, and a lot of that bark on that log had already gone off the thing. He smashed them with such force that bark had flown all over the room. But he takes this log and he walks just a few blocks to Dunwoody. And there's a guy driving by. Can't remember his name, but I name him in the book. I think he's a Asian fellow. But he sees this guy, and what draws him to him, he looks like he's trying to conceal something. And he is. That's Bundy trying to conceal the log. But Bundy's wearing like a peacoat and like a cap on his head. And so that's what they reported. You know, I should mention this, that Bundy was leaving that horrific scene. He was seen by a girl who he didn't see. She was standing back out of the light. He came down the steps. He had this peacoat on his hat. He had the log in his hand, and he went out the door. Okay. Well, this guy saw him dressed that way, holding something to his side, and he could tell he was trying to conceal it. So he took that same log to Dunwoody. By the time he got to Dunwoody, you know, he can already hear the sirens going off. Okay. And they're heading to Chi Omega. And you'd think, whoa, I guess I better go home for the night. But no, he wasn't satiated. So he, you know, there's this duplex, and he gets into this, he comes through the window of Cheryl Thomas, and Debbie Ciccarelli, or whatever her name is, next door, and she hears some noise over there. And sounds like, to her, is like somebody's crying or whimpering or something. And then she hears some, like, banging stuff. So, you know, she's pounding on the wall. She's calling out to her. She even calls her on the phone. Well, Bundy, of course, he had every intention of, you know, having intercourse with her, raping her, either anally or vaginally, and then strangling her. But he couldn't do it because this girl next door kept creating all these problems. So he masturbated. And, you know, and that was found on the bed. And he left the log at the scene, and he got himself together and went out the window. And from that moment on, he went back to his apartment. And, you know, it's a college rooming house, basically. And everybody's up. And, you know, he comes back and, you know, he's not the refined killer of 1974, 1975. People speak to him from the rooming house, and he can barely respond. He's like in a daze. And so that was it. Now then of course, after that, there's this intense manhunt in Tallahassee. You got two people dead. You got another two seriously injured and attacked in the middle of the night as they slept. So that's when he then goes to Lake City and Jacksonville, couldn't get anybody there, and then comes back to Lake City and then kills Kim Leach, which happens to be his last murder anyway. But like I say, the new book I've written, then I go into various things, but I especially go, like, for instance, for the new book, I found a guy named Gary Matthews, who interestingly enough made the run to Chi Omega and dealt with, I think he said he dealt with Karen Chandler. I'd have to check the book and another one. And then after an hour, he made the run to Cheryl Thomas's on Dunwoody. And if it doesn't get, and then it gets more surreal after Bundy's captured, and then Bundy plays his own attorney in one of the upcoming trials. He calls on this guy who has to give a deposition because Bundy's acting like his own attorney. And the guy said he just looked at Bundy and he thought, why, you know, just thought to himself, why Kai Omega? You know, why Dunwoody? You know, but anyway, so yeah. But it was a horrific scene. It was Kai Omega was turned upside down. When I was at Kai Omega in 2008, you know, I didn't go inside, but I took pictures of the front and the back, and they were doing extensive remodeling, and they had a lot of doors propped up, a lot of woodworking torn out, and the doors looked vintage 1970s. So that might have been the first. They have remodeled the outside over the years, but that might have been the first inner remodeling that they've done. But anyway, so yeah, but it's still there. It's still the you know, Kai Omega sorority house.
That's what's nice about your book too. You traveled the route and got the feel and the vibe for, you know, for the horror that happened once upon a time, and then a lot of these places still remained a lot of the same look, if not exactly the same, or pretty close.
Yep.
So you were able to go there and take some great photos, and you're included in there. You also talk about, which is an exclusive too, is that you, which was hard to get, was when Bundy had his experiences with the Mormon faith in Utah and Salt Lake City, and some of the friends that he got as he tried to seriously enter into this LDS, the Church of Latter-day Saints. So tell us about Larry Anderson and a couple of the other people that you met and what you discovered from those interviews with those people in Bundy's life.
Sure. Well, it was very interesting. There's a famous photograph of Bundy and a woman drying dishes at a party. It's one of the few photographs you'll ever see of Bundy outside of a courthouse or a jail or something like that. There just aren't a lot of pictures. I mean, you'll see a couple floating around from his Liz Kendall days. But there's this picture of this real, you know, pretty, you know, a blonde woman, and he's standing there doing the dishes with her. It's a what I call an iconic photograph. Well, that woman was a woman named Carol Bartholomew, and I was able to track down Carol, and she was kind enough to talk with me and open up to me. And she sent me an extensive email as to what her life was, how she knew Ted, how that photograph came about. And I've got the whole story in there. And she talks about John Homer and Larry Anderson. They were a part of that house that four guys lived in. And one of them, the guy who took that photograph, was a fellow named Wynn Bartholomew. And Carol ended up marrying Wynn. And they ended up having a number of children and they, you know, grandchildren. And he became a well-respected attorney in Utah. And he just passed away in 2013. But Carol was extremely nice. And I sent her a copy of my book, The Bundy Murders. And so she was very kind to open up to me. So then when she told me about Larry Anderson and John Homer, I thought, well, perhaps they might like to talk to me. And ultimately they did. And they're two very nice fellas. And they carried a lot of information with them about this, their dealings with Ted and the stuff that they told me, I've never read about any other place. And I know that, that they haven't talked much about it. I don't think any of this information has ever been in print before. And it's just very interesting because you get to see the other side of this. And one of the most interesting things is that, Bundy had asked him to go skiing in Colorado in like January or early winter of 1975. And they were set to go on a particular date in January. I don't know when. I'm not sure if he knows when. But he did say we were going to Vail. Now, Vail is where Bundy ended up getting Julie Cunningham. But whether Bundy went to Vail that time or not, we don't know. Because when he pulled up to the curb to pick Larry up, Larry had all his ski equipment at the curb at his place, ready to go on this trip that Bundy asked him to go on. Bundy pulls up and says, do you mind if I go alone? He said, I need some alone time, which means I need to murder somebody. But of course, Larry doesn't know this. And I'm sure Larry was aghast because he's got all his ski equipment. He's ready to go. And he's not like he's calling from his apartment, hey, I can't go. He pulls up as if he's going and says, I just want to go alone. And so he takes his, you know, he does. And Bundy goes. So that coincided, you know, with one of the murders. We just don't know which one. But I thought that was very enlightening. And so, you know, that need, I kept thinking as I heard the story, that need in Bundy, that churning need to kill must have been rising up. And he probably thought to himself, you know, I can go with Larry and ski, and I'm not going to be able to think about it because I want to go over and kill these women. So it's better to cancel with him. Because, I mean, if it probably would have been at any other time, Bundy may just have gone with him. But he wanted to kill. He felt like he needed to kill, and off he went by himself. And, of course, you know, I'm sure it surprised, you know, Larry. I'm sure he thought it was rude. But Larry had a close relationship with him, and he introduced him to a lot of women in the church. And he even said they double dated on occasion. So he got to know the man very well. So it was very good. Like I say, these stories are being recorded for the first time.
What you have in the book, too, is very interesting for Bundy Files and for people that want to know more details about this fascinating killer. And you have Mike Fisher and Matt Lynchwell, I believe, in Florida. Now, explain to us why the most, in your mind, what was the most credible confession from Bundy about his murders, and why is it the most credible? What was the motivator? What was the motivation for Bundy to tell the truth now, and then tell us how he told the truth in this third person sort of fashion?
Right. He had made confessions before. I think what he told Michelle in conversations with a killer, I think you're getting a lot of good information there. But when it came time, but he wouldn't name names, and he wouldn't talk about everything. But when it came time, like, for example, when he was dealing with some of his, some of the psychiatrists and some of the other people, and just occasionally he would say some things, and they wouldn't match his end-of-life confession. So in my opinion, I mean, I know I'm right about this, but in my opinion, the most trusted confessions are his end-of-life confessions right at the end, when he had to talk to the detectives from the respective states that had missing and murdered women. He had to clear up cases. He had to name names. He had to give details. And he did so. And, you know, he called Mike Fisher before Mike Fisher went down to Florida. And Mike said, look, I'm not going to come down there and listen to some BS. Are you telling things in the third person? You're going to have to come clean. You're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to tell the truth. I'm not going to come down and just listen to you talk about something out of the third person. Well, he did come clean. And that's why they're the most trusted. For example, when I'm doing the research on the book, my first book, The Bundy Murders, I was able to get the transcript of the Idaho investigator. And where Bundy confessed to the murder of not just Lynette Culver from Pocatello, but from the hitchhiker he picked up on his way to law school in September of 1974. Now, Bundy gives great detail how that happened. And he picked up the hitchhiker, and he picked her up just on the outskirts of Boise. Well, he directly names it. This is the end-of-life confession. He said he drove with her down 84 for 3 or 4 hours. And he said that at the time, you know, it was a newer highway and it was an older highway, and it went back and forth. And he was eyeing the river off to, like, his left. And he pulled off and went down some road, and that's where he probably whacked the girl in the head. He grabbed the crowbar from behind, whacked her in the head. He said he whacked her. and took her, dragged her body down the river, had sex with her, strangled her, slid the body into the water. Well, for some reason, now that's the transcript, that's the end-of-life transcript. For some reason, he told one of these other people, and it appears in you know, one of their books, that he was riding through the hills of Idaho looking for a hitchhiker, and then he did this and did that, and it doesn't match up at all, with what he said in the end-of-life confession. Now, you can't blame the people that were listening and wrote it down. I think Bundy lied to them. Now, why he would do that, I don't know. That's why I say in the book, is it possible there could have been a second Idaho hitchhiker? I don't think so, but you could say that's a possibility, but I don't think so. So the end-of-life confessions are the most trusted, the most trusted. You know, the Bundy murders was published in 2009. I finished it in July of 2008. I never did get to hear the transcripts of Dennis Couch, the detective. I couldn't locate them. Last year, Dennis Couch gave those tapes, and they're all over the internet now, to a TV station in Utah, and you can hear it. And, you know, even in that, you know, I knew he took Mike Fisher said that he believes, he's the one that told me he believed that Bundy took a couple of the victims up to his rooming house. Mike thought he kept them in the utility closet. Thought to myself, no, Bundy would have carried them upstairs. He would have. I just know he would have. There's no way he's going to keep it. I've been there. He wouldn't have kept them in the utility closet. I just don't think that. Well, in this thing of tapes of Couch, when he's talking about the abduction of Debbie Kent, he admits there he carried her up to his apartment. And this would be his apartment at 565 First Avenue. So, you know, it's just strange to hear that after all these years. I knew that he had Debbie. He had to have had her either in his apartment or in his car. And it's odd because, you know, he kidnapped her, I guess, a little after 10:20, I can't remember the exact time, from Viewmont High School. She went to the parking lot. But he was calling Liz an hour or so later, just an hour or so later. And there's no way he didn't have her with him, either in the car or up in his apartment. Well, he tells Couch that he took her up to his apartment, and he said he killed her, like, I think the tape says, like, the next day or something, or late. I can't remember. But he did admitting taking her up there. So in any event, it was very odd hearing that after all these years, because that's one tape I had never heard.
Now, you also talk about this confession. He was also very kind of angered that the two officers, the two investigators, were not responding to his pleas, what he thought was a reasonable thing, that he would give information, and that people like himself, that, and you describe it as, I guess, sarcastically as a malady, in that he would be studied. And that it was there was value to law enforcement, because we really didn't touch on it in your book, but it is sort of part of the fictional mythology, and we're going to get to the myths of that have been debunked in this as well, that Ted Bundy was offering advice to law enforcement. He was a very articulate guy. None of these people like Ted really had existed in terms of being studied by anybody before Robert K. Ressler and John Douglas and these guys at the FBI. So he really was like a valuable commodity, it seemed, if he were to be able to tell the truth. They did a bunch of brain scans on him and all kinds of physical and mental tests to see if there was anything out of the ordinary physically or physiologically about Ted Bundy. Was there any value to what Bundy was saying in terms of being studied, or was it, it was no merit to what he had said?
Well, here's the thing about Bundy, to remember this. You know, Bundy could have been alive today. He was offered a plea if he would cop to the murders in Florida. they'd give him life imprisonment. Unless he would have died of natural causes, probably not. Did you get great medical care in prison? He would be there now. Okay, so you know, he blew that. Then he was fighting for his life. Now, Bundy. Here's the thing about killers like Bundy, and this is an absolute fact about Bundy. A man like Bundy kills. It is metaphorically, those people belong to him. He owns them. He knows what happened to him. He owns the process by which they died. You got to understand, Bundy used to be there. He used to love the fact when the air stopped coming out of their mouth, breathing their last. He would look at their fingernails as they would turn. You know, that's what they call, I guess, the cyanotic hue, as the fingernails turn. He loved that. He loved it. He wouldn't miss it for anything. He considered all of that stuff sacred, and he considered it his. The only reason why he gave up the information he gave up was because he saw the Grim Reaper coming for him, and he wanted to stop it. Now, if they'd have housed Bundy somewhere and not put him to death, there's a great chance he'd have clammed up. He might have given them some information. Very arrogant man. And again, he only started giving real and verifiable information because he was trying to save his life. And I'm sure he got angry at a lot of these people. Okay? But, you know, that's just the way it is. He was dishing it out. He was petrified of dying. Of course, the time he died there, that's all a myth that he had to be dragged out, you know, out of the cell. Now, he walked. He walked down there, you know, he sat down in the electric chair. Don Patchen, I know Don well, he came in there, and he was the lead detective on that case down there. That day, Don Patchen was invited by the governor to have lunch. He canceled that because somebody said, "Do you want to come see, you know, Bundy get put to death?" He said, "Yes, I do." So as he walked in there, Bundy, you know, waved his hand at him, very calm. And, you know, he would nod at certain people. But, yeah, I'm sure, you know, by then he was just, you know, he knew that was it. But when he was fighting for his life, he was willing to talk. So if they'd have housed him somewhere, chances are he would have clammed up. He would never, even giving information, there were things he was never going to talk about. When Bob Keppel asked him, you know, he finally got George Ann Hawkins' place, you know, up in where he killed her, away from her, you know, sorority house. And he probably killed her around 1 a.m., okay? But he stayed with her until about 5. Keppel asked him what happened between those hours. Of course, Keppel knows. He was playing with her. He was having sex with her. He was doing all kinds of stuff. But he wouldn't talk about it. He said, "We'll have to." He used to have a phrase. "Well, we, you know, if we have time, we'll get back to that later." He had no intention of getting back to it. He didn't want to admit that he was having sex with a dead body, with George Ann's dead body. He did admit to Keppel he did enjoy the cyanotic hue that he would see on the fingernails of the dead women. There were some things he would admit, but there were other things he just wouldn't talk about, and that goes also for the killing of young girls. As I say in the Bundy murders, slaughtering co-eds is acceptable, apparently, in his mind. But if you start killing them too young, then, oh, no, that's off limits. I can't talk about it. So keeping him alive after that, he might not have gotten anything. It'd just be mockery. You know, if he'd have been alive, I probably wouldn't even gone to see him, and I'll tell you why. I have a short fuse for people around. I probably would have ruined the meeting by saying something, you know, stupid and maybe becoming angry. I got the truth from the record and from the investigators and from everybody involved. A lot of people in Florida said, "Here's how you know Bundy's lying. He's moving his lips." So yeah. I don't know how I don't know how advantageous it is for people to interview him and get anything from him, except I think in the third person, he shot pretty straight to Q Ainsworth and Stephen Michaud. And when Holmes was dealing with him, the criminologist from Louisville, I think he shot straight with Holmes too. But a lot of people could come in and talk to him. I don't know. Like I say, I don't think he shot straight with everybody necessarily that was trying to help him. And now he did tell Dr. Art Norman at the end. He did admit to killing a couple women in New Jersey when he was back east, but he kept pretty shut mouth to everybody else. But see, you almost have to catch Bundy at the right time sometimes to get anything from him. Mike Fisher said, "You've got to get him when he's exhausted. You can't wait till he gets rested." He told the Florida people, "You've got to get information from him while he's exhausted. If you wait until he's rested, he'll clam up, he won't talk." And that's what he did.
Briefly, we've got to give a nod to the late, great Ann Rule, who just passed away last year. And she wrote an incredible book, The Stranger Beside Me. But again, Bundy is an incredible character, and not everything about Bundy was in there. And it really, I think for all the people that read Stranger Beside Me, like myself, we really weren't aware of the necrophile aspect of Ted Bundy. It surely was more than downplayed in there. Now, you include some letters that really aren't so alarming or shocking, but you include them. They're very interesting. And letters to Ann Rule. Now, given that he told the truth to certain people, that certainly makes a lot of sense. He worked at a suicide hotline with Ann Rule, and he corresponded with her right to the very end, and you include some of those letters.
Right.
How much of this of the truth did he tell Ann Rule?
Well, here's the thing, and I'm sorry that I never got to meet Ann Rule, and I would have also liked to have met the other fellow, Larson, who wrote The Deliberate Stranger. But by the time I did my research, he was passed on. I could never locate Rule. Now, what makes Rule's book good is that Rule's book is not a biography of Bundy or the case. What it is, it's her relationship with Bundy. And that's what makes that book so interesting. And she is linked to Bundy. They work together, as crisis counselors. He corresponded with her. They were together at times. She came down to Florida. So, but that's what makes that book unique, because it's her story with him. And I wouldn't call it like a biography like mine or like the only living witness, but that's what makes her book special. Anyway, now, Rule talks about, and the only place I use anything in my book, The Bundy Murders, from Rule, is that in the police record, it talks about when Bundy came back to Washington, after he was out on bail, and he was getting ready. This is 1976, and he was getting ready to stand trial for kidnapping of Carol LaRanche come January. It's 1975. Come January, he would be standing trial. He goes there, and he has lunch with her, and I think it's a French restaurant downtown, and he's being tailed by the cops. And I know that in Ann's Rule book, I think she said they met for 2 hours, and I point this out in the book, but I think the Seattle PD says 3, so there's a discrepancy there. I don't know who's right, but I gave both stories. But Rule mentions in her book, she said that Bundy chose to sit with his back, they must have been in a booth, instead of looking her in the eye. In the eyes, he had his back to her, and he would talk off. And I think that was intentional, that he wouldn't look her in the eye. And this was noticed by Ann Rule. So she might have thought he was doing a little bit of lying. He was being a little bit, cagey with her. And so, that's what she said in the book, that, he just looked straight ahead. So that might have been a tip off to Ann Rule. Still, though, Ann Rule was just like anybody else. It took a long time for her to believe that he could really be capable of these things. So, but basically the connection there, and I'm sorry, did I miss a question you had about that, about Ann Rule?
I just wanted to reference that for those people that know, it was interesting with Ann Rule. I interviewed her in 2005. She was gracious enough, and I was doing a radio show that wasn't specifically true crime, but I had the opportunity to interview her about Bundy and The Stranger Beside Me. And what's so interesting is that she did believe in his innocence, or at least didn't believe he was guilty, one or the other, right to the very end. And when she said she did, she ran out of the courtroom, I believe, and vomited in the washroom.
Yes.
At the at the sort of the idea that yes, this person that she shared so many things with and information with, that she had introduced introduced her young daughter to Ted Bundy and considered him a friend, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so just what was more even more interesting, while they were working at that suicide hotline, she, being a former police officer, was doing some writing with detective magazines, and she just got a publishing deal when and if this person that was running around killing women was caught and apprehended.
Yes.
And it happened
right.
to be the person she was working with that night. And so incredible beginning of anyone's career in true crime, especially when you're dealing with the infamous Ted Bundy.
Well, that's true. And that book will be unique. And it's something. And, but you know what? I think Rule was a friend to him, but I question how much of a friend Bundy was to her. Bundy was into using people. Yeah, so much into using people. But it was a shock to her, as it was to many people, that he turned out to be the killer, because he wore that mask of sanity so well around her, around, you know, everybody that he was with. So it's strange. Yeah. In fact, I thought about her a number of times out when I was out in the Pacific Northwest, west of the Seattle area, and I'm going over these sites. And like I say in the book, I knew she had been in the hospital. 83, you know, that's not all that unusual. But I didn't know she was that sick. And, you know, after my wife and I returned to Louisville, about a week or so later, we heard she passed away. So, yeah, it's a shame. But it's interesting. She did. It was just tough for her to believe that. And that's understandable.
Let's get to, because we only have about 10 minutes left, and I wanted to get to a couple of the biggest myths that surround the Ted myth, Ted Bundy mythology. In that, there's two myths in that part of the reason why Ted Bundy became the monster that he became is because he didn't know that his mother was actually, what he thought he was his sister was actually his mother, and who he thought he was his parents were actually his grandparents. And the second myth is, or at least we can talk about that, is that the reason he chose victims was because they looked like a girlfriend that spurned him early on. She wanted him back, but it was too late, and his victimology was related to the part in her hair and the looks and the comparison with the brown or darker hair with this girlfriend. So let's first tackle myth one and myth two and what you discovered in both of your books, but especially The Trail of Ted Bundy regarding these myths.
Yeah. Well, that really is a myth that he didn't find out until he was much older about his mother. You know, it's weird that was ever believed by him as a little boy, that his mother was his sister and his grandparents were his parents, but that was straightened out when he was a kid. And I don't know how it got there, but it was straightened out. I have found nothing in the record that says it went until he was an adult man. Now, here's what is in the record. He had significant rage because he was illegitimate and he never knew his father. That much is certain. However, if you look to the fracturing of his personality, you've got to go back to when he was a little boy. He was so little, just a little thing, maybe 3 years old, something like that, when he took these kitchen knives and he stuck them in the bed around his aunt under the covers with the points facing towards the body. And she woke up and saw him doing this. Now, that speaks of something really off kilter. That's something really psychologically off that a boy would do that. And, you know, and so something happened to his personality. There is some type of fracturing, not going to be caused because he thought his mother was his sister and that was cured early. But even as an adult man, when he was interviewed by the probation and parole officer after he was convicted in the Carol Durange case. And this probation and parole officer interviewed him to make this report. And he asked about his father. He said that his face got red and became contorted. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
And it took him a moment to calm down. And then he had a response and something, I'm quoting in the book, but it's something like, well, you can say that he left my mother and me and never returned. But that rage that came out of him, you know, somebody can be very sorry they didn't know their father. But most people don't have that. And he's an adult, he's a grown man. And this rage comes up in him. That's the monster reveal. So that was there, but it had nothing to do. I can't find it in the record where he believed that foolish thing about his mother being his sister and all that stuff, grandparents being the parents. That was fixed when he was a little boy. And I'm sorry, what was the second thing again?
Well, the second part was the idea that, you know, everybody knows the story, basically. It was the girlfriend with great expectations.
Oh.
She was wealthy and beautiful, and she thought he was weak and a loser. And so then when he did achieve in her mind the things that he respected and she respected, she seemed to want him back. And at that point, he said no. And people attribute that point in time and that fact, that event.
Yes.
And they link it all to subsequent murders and that cause and effect.
Okay. Yeah, now that was her real name is Diane Edwards. I give her another name in the Bundy murders, and I give her that same name. There's a mention of her in the second book. I think I call her Carla Brown in my book. That's the pseudonym. But her name was Diane Edwards. She was quite striking to look at. She was a very pretty lady. She did have dark hair, if I recall, was parted in the middle. And I talked to other people. They thought, yeah, she was a very nice looking lady. And she was from a wealthy family. She was, you know, she didn't come from the same socioeconomic background as Ted. But she liked Ted. The first time around, you know, I mean, she liked him. He was fun to be with. But he had his things, ways of doing certain things that she didn't like anyway. And, like, he'd use her credit card. He's just kind of a leech to women. But he had baggage. And he didn't look like he was succeeding in some areas. And so she dropped him. And that crushed Bundy. Now, here's the thing. When he got into law school and he started to really kind of surge in life, and people started to take notice, she became interested again. So they started meeting again. And you know, Bundy was at one point off working in Olympia, okay? And, of course, he had Liz Kendall, who believed they were going to get married, and she was helping him through law school and helping him in other ways, you know, financially, and he's working, but she's helping. He's dating Diane Edwards again, or as I say, you know, and so there was a guy I talked to who had hired Bundy for one of these, you know, political jobs. He said, I never even heard of Liz Kendall, but I remember Diane. And so he set it up for them to be married. He asked her and she agreed. But listen to me, he had no intention of marrying her. All this was a getting back at her. She leaves to go back. He had no intention of marrying her. No intention. This is right before he started the murder. I believe this was in December of 73. He would be killing the next month. And he knew it. And so he gets her to marry. This is his way of getting even, evening the score. She goes back to San Francisco. He never calls her again. 6 weeks later, she's calling him saying, well, what's up with you? Why aren't you calling me? Why not this? Why not that? And I say in my book, The Bundy Murders, that, you know, she's stronger than Bundy. But, you know, here's a man who was never at a loss for words with her. He just shuts up and he listens to her. And she said, never call me again. Like I say, that's why I say she's stronger than him. Click. That was it. But what you got to know is that was never real anyway. He just wanted to get her back for what she did to him. That was it.
Now, Kevin, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about The Trail of Ted Bundy. Now, this is a Wild Blue Press release, so
Yes.
Tell us about Wild Blue Press and where best to get this version, and if it's it's in ebook and paperback version. So tell us a little bit about where we can get it best, and a little bit about Wild Blue Press.
Yes. Well, it's my new book, The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories, is out now in trade paper, ebook, and audiobook. And you can go directly to Amazon, or you can go directly to Wild Blue Press. Wild Blue Press is a new publishing company. A lot of authors are involved in it, and it's growing. They're putting out a lot of books. They're adding authors all the time, and I think this is my third book with them, and I'll be doing another. I'm doing research right now on another book that will be published by Wild Blue Press. It's just a great group of people, and a great group of writers, and we all enjoy it very much.
Yeah, it's an author-driven publishing company. Sorry?
Yes. Yeah, I was just saying wildbluepress.com. And I write crime blogs. We all do. If anybody wants to go there, they all – and even though I have books that are published by other publishing companies, they have, them there as well. So you can see all my books. And you can go to the archive blogs and read those as well.
Well, that's great, Kevin. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories. And people want to contact you, they know how to get a hold of you and ask any questions.
Yes.
You're one of those people that's very accessible like that and on true crime discussion
yes.
boards and forums. So you're very out there, and it's been to your benefit, I'm sure. And thank you very much for this interview, and you have a great night, and I hope to hear again
thank
from
you.
You soon.
Thank you, Dan, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night.